This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This is Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from What I Came to Tell You by Tommy Hayes. My brother is not a hillbilly. Emily had whirled around and faced the man. I didn't mean anything by it. The man laughed and looked at his wife, then back at Emily. I think your brother is one hell of a dancer. Don't call him a hillbilly, Emily said, her jaw working. I really don't see the problem. You heard the girl. Another man stepped up to the well-dressed man. Grover had noticed him standing behind them, listening to the music with his wife and two little blonde-haired girls. He had long hair, wore a ball cap and a hunting jacket. I didn't mean anything by it. The well-dressed man wasn't laughing now, and his face had turned pale. Tell him, Gertrude. He turned to his wife, but she pressed her lips together as if this wasn't the first time her husband's mouth had gotten him in trouble. I wouldn't call nobody a hillbilly, the man in the ball cap said, leveling his eyes at the well-dressed man. Not if you expect to live a long and healthy life. Is that a threat? It's one of them health advisories. The well-dressed man started to say something, but seemed to think better of it. He took his wife's hand, and they disappeared through the crowd. Appreciate it, Emily said to the man in the ball cap. He gave her a wink and nodded toward the band. The fella's right. Your brother's good. He stepped back and joined his family. Grover saw the sad look flicker across Emily's face as she watched the man's little girls take their father's hands and lean back against him. The band shifted into a faster song, and as the fiddle sped up, so did Clay's footwork. More people gathered to listen to the music and watch him dance. Emily shrugged off her backpack and joined her brother. Other people stepped out of the crowd, joining Clay and Emily, and pretty soon it seemed as if half the people in the Grove Arcade were dancing. Come on! Emily waved Grover up. He thought about going up, but his feet wouldn't move. He knew good and well that if his mother had been there, she'd have been dancing right in the middle of them. Grover watched Emily drink her hot chocolate. He didn't know if it was the cold or the dancing, but her cheeks had reddened and her eyes glistened. They had stopped in at Bean Street's long enough for Sudie to beat Clay in checkers. Oh, gross, Emily was muttering under her breath. A dreadlocked couple kissed and stuck their tongues into each other's mouths, right in front of their table, where Mr. Crit had hung a sprig of mistletoe on the tip of the mannequin arm coming out of the ceiling. Make me gag, Emily said louder. Grover laughed, nearly spraying hot chocolate everywhere. Don't knock what you haven't tried, sister, the dreadlock girl said to Emily. She nodded toward the mistletoe. Why don't you and your boyfriend give it a whirl? I'm not her boyfriend, Grover said. Never too early to start, the dreadlock guy said. Then, as if he was demonstrating, kissed the dreadlock girl another long kiss. The couple sauntered off toward their table in the back, his hand in her back pocket. Grover couldn't bring himself to look at Emily. He kept his eyes on the checkerboard as Sudie quickly finished off Clay. When he finally did look up, the expression on Emily's face wasn't at all what he'd expected. He couldn't be sure, but he thought she looked a little hurt. In case you hadn't noticed, my sister has a thing for Thomas Wolfe, Clay said, as Emily ran ahead and disappeared into the old Kentucky home. Clay looked at the rocking chairs lined up on the long porch. "The guest used to sit out here in the summers," Sudie said. "A long time ago, people stayed in boarding houses like this when they visited Asheville. Now they stay in hotels." She pointed to the Renaissance Hotel, a huge 10-story hotel across from the Wolf House. "Daddy says the Wolf House has been in the hotel's shadow since the day it was built." Shading his eyes with his hands, Clay frowned up into the sky. Looking over at the hotel and then back at the Wolf House. "Now, I may be wrong. Wouldn't be the first time. But unless I'm sorely mistaken, the path of the sun over these two buildings is such that the Wolf House would never find itself in that big old hotel's shadow." Inside, the first thing Grover noticed was the bright smell of pine and fir. Along the edges of the main exhibit room lay wreaths, a small stack of cut fir trees, and another neat pile of garlands made from pine branches. Emily was already at the exhibits, stopping to read every word, something Grover hadn't done in all the years he'd come here. Little Bit and several of the tour guides were draping garlands around the main room. "He's in his office," Little Bit said, handing a garland to a tour guide on a ladder. "You really are having a Thomas Wolfe Christmas," Sudie said. Little Bit glanced off toward their father's office. "I thought your daddy would have a fit when he saw the bill. Instead, he said to make sure I got whatever I needed." She lowered her voice. "His mood has improved lately." Grover walked to his father's half-open office door and found him standing at his desk with Leela beside him. They were looking at an open book on the desk. The way they leaned together, almost touching, gave Grover an odd feeling. He knocked. Leela and their father stepped back from each other. "Come on in," his father said. A tinge of red crept across his father's face. "I was showing Leela a first edition Look Homeward Angel." When Leela Roundtree looked up from the book, it hit Grover how pretty she was, and how she wasn't just somebody's mother. He thought about how his father had accepted rides from the round trees in the mornings, how he and Leela had started going on walks after supper, how he came back from those walks in a good mood. His father led the round trees through the house, starting downstairs, taking them through the dining room, the kitchen, the piano parlor, the sunroom parlor, and then upstairs to the bedrooms. He showed them the room where Wolf's brother Ben had died. Even without reading the book, Grover had heard his father's spiel enough to know that Ben, Wolf's older brother, was the angel in Look Homeward, Angel. With no other visitors around, his father unhooked the velvet ropes and let the round trees walk throughout the rooms. Emily hardly said a word the whole time. She seemed to soak it all in. One of the last rooms they visited was the bedroom where Wolf's father died. "This is the very bed he died in," Grover's father said. "I'll be," Clay said. "Was he like Gant in the book?" Leela asked. "A funny guy," his father said, "full of life. Quoted long passages of Shakespeare, built roaring fires, and on occasion given to excess." "Given to what?" Clay asked. "Drank too much," Sudie said. As Grover's father led Leela and Clay on down the hall to another room, Grover noticed Emily linger. She laid her hand flat on the bed where Wolf's father had died. Grover came and stood beside her. "They know of at least 11 people who died in this house," Grover said. He heard his father's voice down the hall. Grover placed his hand on the bed. Of course, everybody who ever lived in this place must be dead now. Emily looked at him. Wolf's father, his mother, his brothers and sisters, all dead. Every boarder who ever stayed here has to be dead, and Wolf's been dead since 1938. "What are you saying?" Emily asked. Grover shrugged. "Just that everybody's dead." "Or getting there," Emily said. Careful to replace the felt rope, Grover led Emily in the direction his father had taken Leela and Clay and Sudie, but found himself leading her down the hall toward the sleeping porch, where Wolf spent many nights, and where he'd had to share the room with whatever boarder might be staying there at the time. It was Grover's favorite room because it had so many windows and was lighter than the rest of the house. He never knew from night to night where he'd have to sleep, Grover said, or who he'd have to share a room with. He pointed to the two beds that took up most of the room. His mother was so cheap, she'd squeeze as many beds into a room as she could. She even rented to people with tuberculosis. When he died of tuberculosis of the brain, they said he might have caught it from having to sleep in boarders' beds. They could hear his father's voice down the hall as he reeled off facts about Wolf's seven brothers and sisters. Outside, the wind whistled, and a loose shutter tapped against the house. Grover reached for Emily's hand. She looked at him, and then down at his hand holding hers. Her hand was warm and rough at the same time. He let go. They didn't say anything. The wind whistled outside, and the shutter continued to tap against the house. The two of them stood watching the wind and the bare trees and the light fading outside. Down the hall, their family's voices were coming toward them. Chapter 12. Merlin Wants In. "Class, line up for lunch," said Mrs. Caswell. Chairs scraped as the kids lined up with their parents. It was Wednesday when the school served Thanksgiving lunch and family were invited. Sam's father was in line, Mira's mom, Ashley's mom, both of Daniel Pivo's parents, and his grandmother, too. Almost everyone had a parent with them. Some had both. The other night, Sudie had invited their father to the Claxton Thanksgiving lunch, but he had a business lunch he couldn't miss. Sudie was disappointed, but hadn't said anything. All morning, Grover had held out hope that their father, who was known for surprises, might show at the last minute. Still in her nurse's uniform, Emily's mother arrived as Mrs. Caswell led the line down the hall. Emily, who'd been quiet all morning, gave her mother a weak smile, and Leela put her arm around her shoulder. "Is your daddy coming?" Leela asked Grover as the line started down the stairway. "He's busy," Grover said. "He has a lot on his shoulders these days," Leela said. Why did adults always make excuses for each other? When his class filed past the offices, Grover noticed Miss Snyder at her desk doing paperwork. He darted into her office. He'd been to see her a few times since the first meeting, and had stopped feeling quite so strange passing her office. It didn't feel like his mother's anymore. Miss Snyder looked up from a form she was filling out. "Would you sit with Sudie at lunch?" Grover asked. "Our father can't come." "What about you?" Miss Snyder asked. "I guess I could eat with her, but it wouldn't be special." "What I mean is," she said, "would you like me to sit with you too?" "That's okay," he said. "Why is it okay? I don't need anybody sitting with me." "Why is that?"
"I'm older."
"I see." Miss Snyder rubbed her chin. "So older kids don't need people to sit with them?"
"Well, there's that," he said. "Plus, talking to people tires me out."
"Like now?" she asked. "Am I tiring you out?"
He glanced back at the passing line of his class.
"Of course I'll sit with her," she said. In the cafeteria, he sat beside Sam, whose father sat across from him, talking and laughing. Dr. Newcomer was a very funny, very nice man, and a good father, it seemed to Grover. He'd coached Sam's soccer team for years, had been a troop leader in Sam's Boy Scout troop, and was always doing things with Sam, like taking him camping in the Smokies, or skiing up at Wolf Ridge, or to see a basketball game in Chapel Hill. Emily sat on the other side of him, hardly speaking to her mother. This didn't seem to bother Leela, who talked a lot to Mira's mother, the mayor of Asheville, and a big supporter of the Wolf House. Halfway through the meal, Grover leaned over to Emily and said, "Pretty good turkey, huh?" Emily smiled, but seemed to drift back to wherever she'd been. After school, Grover went to work in the bamboo forest. As usual, Clay came over and helped. The tapestries Grover was working on had gotten so big he needed an assistant to stand on the other side to help him weave in the long limbs. For sale signs, like stubborn weeds, had kept sprouting up almost as fast as Grover tossed them into the bamboo. He'd stopped when a police car started cruising their street, slowing in front of the bamboo forest. His father said the lot might not sell, that times were tight, and few people would be able or willing to pay $250,000 for 2 little acres. Grover continued to go out to the bamboo forest every day, working harder than ever since any day could be his last. "What was wrong with Emily today?" Grover asked as he pushed a long hemlock limb into an opening. "This time of year is hard for her," Clay said, taking the limb and sliding it back toward Grover. "It's hard for all of us, but it's special hard for Emily."
"How come?"
"Daddy was killed on Thanksgiving 4 years ago. Clay's eyes looked at him through a slot in the tapestry. His dying was hardest on Emily. I didn't know him as good since I was so little when he first went over there. It was about dark when Grover and Clay straightened up the studio, putting everything neatly away. Grover picked up his toolbox, and together Clay and Grover walked out of the bamboo forest. The street lights buzzed on, and snowflakes whirled down through the light. "The first snow of the year," Grover said, putting his hand out. His heart lifted a little at the sight of it. "Back home they would have had a bunch of snows by now," Clay said. They walked up the middle of Edgemont, looking up at the snow. When they came even with their houses, Grover heard a cat cry. Merlin sat on the sill outside the Round Tree's front window. He seemed to be looking at a flame flickering. "Merlin wants in," Clay said. "What's with the candle?" "Every evening, from now till Christmas, Emily will light that candle for Daddy and set it in the window. She's done it every year since he died. Says it's to guide his spirit home. The only thing is that it's also Merlin's perch, and when Emily set the candle there, he jumped up and knocked it down, nearly caught the house on fire.
Mama said we have to keep him out whenever Emily lights that candle. A dark figure walked slowly up the street. Whoever it was tired. Grover recognized the battered hat. Jesse had on overalls and muddy work boots, and snow collected on the brim of his hat. He looked at Grover's toolbox. "Y'all been hard at it?" "Grover's working on a monster weaving," Clay said. "What's that racket?" Jesse walked into the Round Tree's yard and lifted Merlin off their windowsill and carried him back, holding the cat in his arms like a baby. "Cat, you're one bothersome feline." "Mama makes us put him out so he'll come home to you," Clay said, petting Merlin. "She says it's important Merlin knows he's your cat." "Merlin belongs to no man," Jesse said, as the cat squirmed out of his arms, dropped to the ground, and disappeared into the dark. Headlights swept across the bottom of the street, and Grover could tell by the engine's rattle that it was his father's car. The headlights lit up the air, showing how heavy the snow fell. Grover and Clay and Jesse moved to the sidewalk as Grover's father pulled even with them. He rolled down his window. "It's coming down, isn't it?" his father said, sounding like he'd had a good day at the Wolf House. "Charles said they're calling for 8 inches," Jesse said. Charles was the big guy who operated the backhoe at Riverside. "Maybe we ought to do our grocery shopping tonight, in case everything is shut down tomorrow. We can grab a bite to eat at Five Points and then head over to the co-op," their father said. "Give me a few minutes to get out of these work clothes," Jesse said. He started up the street. "Clay," their father said, "I'm glad y'all can join us for Thanksgiving." This was the first Grover had heard about the Round Trees eating Thanksgiving with them. As he watched his father pull into the drive, Grover thought there seemed to be a good bit of communication with Leela that he wasn't in on. "I better get home," Clay said. "Mama'll wonder where I am. See you, Grover." "See you," Grover said, picking up his toolbox. He started up the front walk, but then turned to watch Clay walk across their yard and disappear inside. The snow was coming down even harder. The candle flickering in the Round Tree's front window gave Grover a warm and dizzy feeling, like he was falling but being held up at the same time. The waitress refilled Jesse's coffee cup and then their father's. "Could I get some ketchup, please?" Sudie said, looking at the pile of French fries next to her hamburger. The waitress, a UNC Asheville student, had tattoos up and down her arms and a nose stud. She pulled a bottle of catsup out of her uniform pocket and set it in front of Sudie. "And I'd like some Parmesan cheese," Grover said. The waitress grabbed a shaker of Parmesan off an empty table across from them. "Let me know if you need anything else." Five Points Cafe sat on the edge of Montford and was only a few blocks from their house. Out the window, snow had already collected on Jesse's truck. Jesse had driven them over in his pickup, which did well in the snow. Jesse and Grover sat on one side of a booth, and Sudie and their father sat across from them. Grover and Sudie had eaten at Five Points since they were little, always with their father. In the mornings, it was filled with workmen, sitting at the counter, drinking coffee and talking. Their mother wasn't crazy about Five Points, saying the food was greasy, so they only ate there when their mother was away or at a meeting. Eating here tonight had given Grover the uneasy feeling that their mother was just at a PTO meeting or out with her book group. "And cranberry sauce," Jesse said, taking the pencil from behind his ear and adding to the grocery list he'd made on his napkin. "And crescent rolls?" Sudie asked, dipping a French fry in catsup. "What's Thanksgiving without crescent rolls?" Jesse asked their father how the Wolf House had gone today, and it struck Grover that Jesse had taken over the job of asking the questions their mother used to ask. "I don't know about this Thomas Wolfe Christmas thing," their father said. "All we have so far is a couple of school groups scheduled for a tour after Thanksgiving." "That's a good start," Jesse said, just like their mother would have said. "It'll take a lot more than a couple of high school classes to recoup what we've spent on decorations and advertising," their father said. "It'll take even more to get Lunsford off my back." "Speaking of the old boy," Jesse said, "how'd your talk with him go?" Grover's father frowned at Jesse. "You went to see Mr. Lunsford?" Grover asked, wiping spaghetti sauce from his mouth with his napkin. "Sorry about that, Walt," Jesse said. "I forgot it was a secret." "The cat's out of the bag," his father said, giving Jesse a look. "I went to see him about your bamboo forest."
"You did?"
"At lunch today. Was the only time he could work me in." So that was why his father hadn't been able to come to the Thanksgiving lunch at Claxton. "I was hoping I might talk him down," his father said.
"You offered to buy it?"
Grover's fork clattered onto his plate. "With your mother's life insurance money coming soon," his father said, "I thought maybe we could afford it, if he'd come down to a reasonable price." He looked at Jesse. "I told him how it had meant a lot to the neighborhood kids over the years, and how my son did his artwork there. But he said he couldn't afford to go any lower. He said he was sorry, but he really needed the money for his grandkids' college." Grover started to eat, but then set the fork back down. The bamboo forest was definitely going to get sold. Somehow, up until this moment, and even with the for sale signs piling up, a part of him had believed it might not happen. Then Lunsford gave me a funny look and said, "You wouldn't happen to know who's been pulling up the surveyor's stakes over there, would you? Or my signs?" His father rubbed his forehead, looking at Grover and Sudie. "Y'all have to stop pulling up those signs. That's all I need is for him to find out we're behind that." "I stopped when the police started coming by," Grover said. "The police?" his father said. "I know the bamboo forest means a lot to you two, but Lunsford probably wouldn't mind getting rid of me. So you have to be on your best behavior here on in, or the bamboo forest might not be the only thing we lose." Grover had overheard his parents a few years before, when Mr. Lunsford had started talking again about demolishing the Wolf House, that if their father lost his job and they needed money, they could sell their house. It was paid for. "Maybe the bamboo forest won't sell," Sudie said. "He's asking about three times what that land is worth," said Jesse. "Look how it's coming down," a man said in the booth behind theirs. The snow fell so fast and thick, it looked like the windows had been covered with white sheets. Grover thought how his father had gone to Mr. Lunsford, a man who was as close to an enemy he'd probably ever had, and asked to buy the bamboo forest. His father hadn't forgotten him. The sight of all the snow sent a vaguely familiar lightness up through his chest. It had been so long since he'd felt this way that at first Grover didn't recognize what had crept up on him. It wasn't happiness exactly, but it was in the neighborhood. As they were walking out the front door, Matthew happened to be heading in. He stepped back and held the door open for them.
"Thanks," Jesse said.
"Sure thing," Matthew said. He nodded to their father, but didn't look him in the eye.
"Matthew," their father said, smiling a strained smile.
Matthew's eyes lit briefly on Sudi and Grover, then he walked on inside.
"How's he working out?" their father asked Jesse as they squeezed into the truck.
"He's dependable," Jesse said, cranking the engine and turning on the windshield wipers, which wiped away the blanket of snow already on the windshield.
"I ask him to do something, he does it."
"Then you did right," their father said. "Hiring him, I mean."
"He says he'll be finishing up his degree this semester," Jesse said.
"That's a good thing," their father said, looking out at the snow. He sounded miles away. As they made room in the refrigerator for the turkey, the lights flickered.
"I'm wondering," Jesse said, "if we might should go ahead and cook this bird in case the power quits on us."
There was a pause when it seemed to Grover everybody must have been thinking the same thing. Their mother had always been the one to cook the turkey.
"They print directions on the turkey," Sudi said.
Jesse lifted the turkey out of the refrigerator and set it on the counter, reading the little square box full of cooking directions on the wrapper.
"What does it say to cook it on?" Grover's father said, turning on the oven.
"Let's see," Jesse said, squinting at the wrapper. 350. Grover's father set the dial on the oven. Jesse rolled up his sleeves as Sudi handed him a pair of their mother's kitchen scissors, then cut off the plastic wrapper and set it aside with the directions facing up. Checking the directions a couple more times, he pulled out the gizzard, the neck, and the giblets too, rubbed some olive oil and salt and pepper onto the turkey, and started to slide it into the oven.
"Mama always put on a little tinfoil tent to keep it from drying out," Sudi said.
Jesse pulled the turkey back out of the oven.
"Reckon you can make us one?"
Sudi had already gotten out the tinfoil and was tearing off a section. She folded it neatly into a little tent and set it on the turkey. Then Jesse slid it into the oven.
"Says you want to cook him 15 minutes per pound," Jesse said, squinting at the directions. "And he's a 19-pounder, so let's see."
285 minutes, Grover said, "or 4 hours and 45 minutes.
"Mama takes the tent off an hour before it's done cooking," Sudi said, and then, like she'd heard herself use the present tense with their mother, her face darkened a little.
"In 3 hours and 45 minutes, we'll want to take the tinfoil off," Grover said, "so we'll need to do that at 1:30.
"I'll set my alarm clock," their father said, stifling a yawn.
"I could cook it at my house, Walt," Jesse said, "if you don't want to get up. 'Cause once you're up, you'd have to wait another hour after you take the tinfoil off."
His father groaned. "I don't know if I can manage that. It's been a long day."
"I'll do it," Grover said. "I'm not tired."
The possibility of a big snow was one of the most exciting things that had happened in a while, and Grover was wide awake.
"I'll stay up with him," Sudi said.
"I don't know," his father said.
"Please, Daddy," Sudi said, putting her hands together.
"Tomorrow's Thanksgiving. It's not like I have to get up to go to school."
"I guess it won't hurt anything for you to keep Grover company."
"Yes," Sudi said, pumping her fist.
Jesse went home, saying he'd be back tomorrow to start cooking, and their father stoked up the stove in the living room, then went to bed. Sudi got into her pajamas, dragged a quilt in from her room, and settled onto the couch with a new Ramona book.
Biscuit jumped up beside her.
Grover pulled a chair to the front window
and watched the snow. He studied Jesse's rental house across the street. Before the round trees had moved in, it had seemed a kind of shell that college students, like hermit crabs, moved into and out of. With the round trees over there, it had started to feel different. Tonight, with the white lines of snow collecting on the eaves and along the roof ridge, and the stubborn candle burning in the dark center, there was no denying that Jesse's rental house had become a home. Grover woke to his watch beeping. He sat up, yawned, and stretched. The first thing he noticed was the sweet smell of turkey. He checked his watch. 1:30. Sudi was asleep on the couch with Biscuit. The TV was still on, some BBC news program. The wood stove ticked with heat. Outside, it was snowing still. He couldn't ever remember a snow like this. The trees and shrubs in the front yard bowed with snow. It must have been close to a foot by now. He turned off the TV, pulled the quilt up around Sudi, and went out to the kitchen. He started to open the oven. Remembered the oven mittens, put them on, then slid the turkey halfway out, pulled off the tinfoil tent, and slid the turkey back in. He set his watch for 1 hour when the turkey would be done. He stood at the window looking at all the snow. He had an hour he could actually get some work done. He dug snow boots out of the back of his closet, put 2 flashlights in his coat pockets, pulled on his gloves and a wool hat, and closed the front door quietly behind him. The first thing he noticed was the silence. No sounds of traffic, no barking dogs, no distant sirens. Nothing except the occasional snap of a branch or limb somewhere, giving under the weight of the snow. The snow absorbed house lights, street lights, and lights from downtown, so that it looked like it glowed from within. Grover started out, but heard Biscuit bark inside. He opened the door, and without looking, the dog took his usual flying leap off the front steps, and with a little poof, sank out of sight. Now his bark sounded panicked. Grover dug him up out of the snow and held the shivering little dog in his arms. It's too deep. He set Biscuit back inside the house and closed the door. He slogged his way over to the bamboo forest, his boots squeaking in the powdery snow. The bamboo bent over with snow. Some shoots bent all the way over, but when he knocked the snow off, they sprang up like catapults, showering him with snow. His studio didn't look like itself, just a bunch of white mounds. His heart skipped a beat when he saw the weaving he'd been working on, bent nearly in half with the weight of the snow. He hurried over, shook the snow off, and as he did, it sprang back into shape. He pulled out the flashlights, set them in little holders he'd made by lashing some bamboo together. Then he turned them onto the weaving. He dragged a pine limb from underneath a snowy pile and started weaving it in. He'd never worked in the snow before. He'd never worked at 2 in the morning before. He'd weave the end of the limb into one side, then walk around and weave it into the other. It was much slower than when Clay helped him, but pretty soon he had the hang of it. He'd weave, walk around to the other side, then weave, and walk around again. He liked working this way in the snow, in the dark, in all the silence.
After a while, he became so warm walking back and forth that he ended up unbuttoning his coat and taking off his hat. As he did, whenever the work went well, Grover lost himself, forgot about place, forgot about time, forgot about himself. He'd finished the limb and was starting on another when his watch beeped. Uh-oh. He grabbed the flashlights, stuffed them into his coat pockets, and ran toward the house. But running in the deep snow was like running in slow motion. He turned up his walk when he noticed the candle flickering in the round tree's window. Had they meant to leave it burning all night? He remembered a few years ago how a family over on Pearson Street had all burned to death when their Christmas tree had caught fire in the middle of the night. He crossed the road and walked down their front walk. The yard dipped right in front of the house, so that the bottom of the window was eye level with whoever stood in the yard. Grover pressed against their window, staring into the candle flame. It was a large, sturdy candle, and he didn't see any curtains that might catch fire. He started to turn back when he was startled by a movement above him. A white shadow emerged in the window, the shape of a woman in her nightgown, Leela Roundtree. His heart began to pound. He felt a dry lump in his throat, as if suddenly he was in a place he shouldn't be, looking at something he shouldn't. How long had she been standing there? Or had she just come to the window? She didn't seem to see him. The vague white oval of her face turned toward the street, like she was looking for someone. What was she looking for? Her husband? His ghost? Or was she looking at Grover's house? Grover didn't dare move, praying she didn't look down. How would he explain himself? What would the round trees think if they caught him at their window? Yet he couldn't take his eyes off the womanly shape of her, the curves pushing gently against the nightgown. His watch gave a single beep. The turkey! Grover prayed it wasn't burning. But if it came down to burning the turkey, or being caught here at the window staring at Leela Roundtree in her nightgown, the turkey could be charred to a crisp. Just as he was thinking maybe he should make a run for it, the luminous shadow above him leaned into the circle of light, and what he saw made his heart move up into his throat. Holding her long hair back from the flame, Emily leaned in and blew the candle out. Chapter 13. Small Talk. The next morning, Grover woke to a too bright room. He glanced at his watch. 10 o'clock? He hated being late to the bamboo forest. He started to get out of bed, then stopped. Last night, was it a dream? He heard kids yelling and laughing outside. He went to his window and had to squint at all the sunlight reflecting off what looked like about a foot of snow. Last night had been real, all of it, walking around outside by himself in the falling snow, working in the bamboo forest in the deep, deep silence, the flickering candle in the round tree's window, the shadow, Emily in the window in her nightgown. This last he remembered with a pang of guilt, and a pang of something else, a new feeling that somehow felt familiar, like he'd been away and come back into himself for the first time. Back into his legs, back into his arms, into his feet, into his hands, into his toes, his fingers, into every little cell of himself. He needed to talk to somebody, and he knew who that somebody was. Grover dressed and went out to the kitchen, where Jesse, in an apron, was sliding a couple of pecan pies out of the oven and setting them off to the side. Sudie sat at the breakfast table in her pajamas, crumbling cornbread into a bowl. "Your father left these for you." Jesse took a plate of French toast out of the toaster oven and set it on the table in front of Grover, along with a bottle of maple syrup. "He walked over to the Wolf House," Sudie said. "Wanted to make sure none of those big sycamores had dropped limbs on it," Jesse said. "Good job on the bird." He nodded at the brown, glistening turkey that sat on the counter. Grover devoured the French toast and downed a glass of milk, then grabbed his coat off the hook by the kitchen door, pulled on his gloves and his hat, and stomped into his boots. It was so bright outside, he had to shield his eyes with his hand. The storm had passed through in the early morning, leaving the day clear and cold. Kids were out sledding, throwing snowballs, building snowmen. Grover found Sam at the far end of Riverside, where kids were hurling themselves down a big hill they called Dead Man's Descent. "I don't believe it," Sam said, as he trudged back up the hill, pulling his sled. "Couldn't resist the snow, huh? Where's your sled?" "I need advice," Grover said. "What kind of advice?" "Not right here," Grover said, looking back at all the kids. The two of them walked down one of the little roads that ran between the headstones, Sam pulling his sled behind him. Grover looked across the cemetery, then back at Sam. "How do you ask a girl?"
"Ask a girl what?"
"How do you ask a girl to go somewhere with you?"
"In English is best," Sam said.
"I'm serious," Grover said.
"And if you ask me," Sam said, his voice going hard, "that's your whole problem. You're way too serious, and have been ever since..."
He seemed to stop himself.
"Since what?" Grover asked.
"Nothing," Sam said.
"Since my mother died?" Grover asked. "Is that what you mean? I got serious when Mama was hit by a car?"
Sam turned and started back in the direction of the sledding. Grover ran up in front of him.
"It is sort of serious, Sam. When your mother gets killed, it doesn't make you feel all that great, in case you hadn't noticed."
"I didn't mean it like that," Sam said quietly, and stepped around him. Grover stopped, watching his old friend walk away.
"Sam!"
Sam kept walking.
"My mother is dead."
His words echoed off the white hills and came back to him as hard and cold as the snow-topped headstones. Sam turned around.
"So what, Grover?"
The words hung in the air between them. Sam took a couple of steps back toward Grover. "You stopped riding bikes with me, stopped skateboarding with me, stopped coming to our house," he shrugged, "stopped being my friend. I already told you, just because your mother's dead doesn't mean you have to be." The boys looked at each other. Grover was surprised that their friendship had meant that much to Sam. Sam had all kinds of friends.
"I'm sorry I stopped coming up to your house," Grover said.
Sam looked at the ground. "Will you help me?" Grover said. Sam gave a big sigh. "All you have to do is wait till you're by yourself with Emily and ask her to the Christmas waltz."
"Who said anything about Emily?"
"You're hopeless." Sam started up a path, up a big hill, pulling his sled with him.
"Okay, okay, so it is Emily."
Sam stopped and waited for Grover, and together they walked up a path lined by great shaggy hemlocks, their limbs bowed with snow. Grover had gotten more than a few of his limbs for his tapestries from up here. Jesse had said these trees were the oldest in the cemetery and had been here hundreds of years before there were graves. Grover sometimes thought about all the generations of people these trees had seen buried.
"I held her hand," Grover said. Sam stopped. "Emily's?"
"Once," Grover said, holding up a finger, "sort of, when we were going through the wolf house." Sam raised his eyebrows like he was impressed.
"I'm not even sure she really noticed," Grover said.
"Oh, she noticed," Sam said.
"How do you know?" Grover asked.
"Girls never not notice. Noticing is one of their main things."
"How do I ask her to go with me?"
Grover reached inside his coat and pulled out his little sketchbook and his mechanical pencil.
"You're taking notes?" Sam asked.
"What do I say first?" Grover clicked his pencil, getting ready to write.
"Hello is usually a good start," Sam said, watching Grover scribble in his notebook.
"I can't believe you wrote that down."
"What next?"
"Don't ask her right off. You need to make small talk first."
"Small talk?" Grover asked.
"You need to talk about other things."
"How do I do that?"
"Talk about what you usually talk about. I see you talking to her on the playground and in class too sometimes."
Sam looked away. "In fact, you talk to her more than you talk to anybody else these days, her and her brother."
It had never occurred to Grover that Sam might be jealous of the round trees.
"They're just around," Grover said. "It's not like I go get them. Clay just comes over, and he likes the bamboo forest. So does Emily." He kicked at the snow.
"But it all feels different now with Emily," Grover said, closing his sketchbook, "after last night."
"Last night?" Sam asked.
"Nothing." No way was Grover going to tell Sam about seeing Emily in her nightgown.
"So," Grover said, lifting up his notebook, getting his pencil ready to write.
"You don't want to rush into asking her."
"Don't rush," Grover said aloud as he wrote the words and circled them.
"You don't want her thinking it's a big deal to you," he said. "Just be talking to her about whatever it is y'all usually talk about. And then ask her like you just thought of it right then, like it's no big deal."
Grover wrote the words "no big deal" in his notebook and underlined them twice.
"I never knew asking a girl was so complicated."
"Girls are more complicated than algebraic equations," Sam said.
"Algebra isn't complicated," Grover said.
"Okay, Einstein, so girls are more complicated than quantum physics."
Grover closed his notebook. "I'll never be able to do this."
"I didn't mean that about quantum physics," Sam said. "I don't even know what quantum physics is."
"I can't do it," Grover said.
"You need a little practice."
"Practice?"
"Role-playing. My dad uses it with his patients. I'll be Emily."
Grover laughed.
"Ask me to go out with you."
"You're serious?" Grover said.
"It'll help, I swear."
"I'm not asking you to go to the waltz with me."
"You won't be asking me, you'll be asking Emily."
"This is totally random," Grover said. He tugged on a low limb of a hemlock, bringing snow down on both their heads.
"Did you know that hemlocks might be wiped out in 10 years?
The woolly adelgid, a tiny insect from Asia, is killing them."
Grover looked at the limb.
"This would go good in my tapestry."
"You're stalling," Sam said.
Grover let go of the limb.
"So, what do we do?"
"Let's say you've rung Emily's doorbell." Sam stepped between two headstones and opened an imaginary door.
"Oh, hello, Grover."
"Do you have something in your eye?" Grover asked.
"I'm flirting with you," Sam said.
"Gross. It's role-playing. Emily doesn't blink her eyes like that. You look like an owl."
"Let me try again." He turned away, then after a minute turned back.
"Hi, Grover.
You make a terrible girl."
"Okay, okay," Sam said, turning his back to Grover again.
"I think I've got it now."
Then he turned around. Before he could get a word out, Grover was shaking his head.
"She doesn't fake smile. There's nothing fake about Emily."
"I don't think I'm going to get Emily right for you," Sam said. He lay down on his sled on his stomach and aimed it down a steep hill.
"Can you give me a push?"
He held up his legs. Grover took hold of his boots.
"What am I supposed to do?"
"You'll figure it out." Grover ran, pushing Sam over a little hump, and then the sled took off on its own. His friend expertly steered the sled between a couple of headstones and then around a big hemlock. He remembered going to the funeral of Lee Sullivan, a tall, red-headed boy who back in third grade had been sledding down a street and slammed into a parked car. A bunch of crows started cawing loudly overhead. At first, Grover didn't see the red-tailed hawk. He just heard its high, fierce screech. Then he saw the hawk at the center of all the confusion, getting dive-bombed by a dozen angry crows. What impressed Grover was the way the hawk calmly continued circling, keeping its mile-seeing eyes to the ground, looking for prey.
Chapter 14. Suit Yourself. When the doorbell rang a little after 7, their father answered it. The door nearly flew open from the wind. Leela came in first, followed by Clay, and then Emily, who had a book under one arm. Did she plan to read through Thanksgiving dinner?
"That wind is something fierce," Leela said, pushing her hair back out of her face. Their father helped her off with her coat.
"You look great," he said. She wore a deep red dress that somehow showed up her face. She had on lipstick and sparkly earrings. Grover felt betrayed to see his father's eyes linger on another woman the way they used to linger on their mother.
"Let me take your coat," Sudie said to Clay.
"Thank you kindly," Clay said, handing her his coat.
Grover stood looking at Emily, who hadn't looked up at him.
"Help Emily with her coat," their father said. Emily took her coat off herself and held it out to Grover without a word. He'd worried all day that she'd seen him last night standing at her window, staring at her in her nightgown. He carried the coats to his bedroom and laid them on his bed. His bedroom had been where they had always put guest coats, back when they used to have people over. The wind rattled the bamboo outside his window. A loose shutter flapped against the house, and the lights flickered. Back in the main room, Leela and their father and Jesse sat around the roaring wood stove, sipping from glasses of wine. This reading of What I Came to Tell You by Tommy Hayes will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina.